What's a pate knot? While the Loire has become famous for starting the pate knot craze, really it is nothing more than a revival of an ancient way of making sparkling wine that probably first happened by accident. This is the way old Prosecco was made. The process is also called Il Metodo Ancestrale, or Méthode Ancestrale. The wine goes into the bottle with a little unfermented sugar, and the fermentation continues. The CO2 is trapped. The result is a bubbly pleasure that is a tiny bit more grapey than the products of its more fancy cousin, the Champenoise method. Back in the 90s, a much-loved winemaker, the late Christian Chaussard, made a still wine that turned out bubbly. Merde, he thought, there goes that batch of wine. Turns out it was a particularly fun sparkler, and even though, as Pascaline recalls, the late Gaston Huet claims the term pétillon was already used, the new generation shortened it to pate knot. The informal bubble spread around the world, even to Australia and the United States. It's a less expensive process than champagne and easy to drink. The new laws in Mont-Louis pay it homage. It is the only standard on record where the wine must undergo natural fermentation. It also has to be on the lees for 9 months, after which, unfortunately for many who don't believe in it, the lees need to be disgorged so it is nice and clean to the eye. Who to drink? Vouvray. Domaine Huet, biodynamic. Claude Naudin, Philippe Foreau, sustainable. François Pinon, organic. Domaine Vincent Carême, organic. Michel Autrin, organic. Mathieu Combe, organic. Florent Combe, organic. Sébastien Brunet, organic. Catherine et Pierre Breton, biodynamic. Mont-Louis-sur-Loire. François Chidane, biodynamic. Coralie and Damien de la Chenau, Lagrange Tiffane, organic. Lise and Bertrand Jousset, organic. France Saumon, organic. Xavier Weisskopf, Le Rocher de Violette, organic. Ludwig Chanson, organic. Chinon, Bourgogne, and Saint-Nicolas de Bourgogne. At the most western part of the Touraine is a trio of towns synonymous with the grape Cabernet Franc. All are worthy companions to the grape. At the top of the group, however, is Chinon. It should be famous, but somehow it is still not a household name. A quote I found in a 1940s wine book, Yearbook of French Quality Wines, Spirits, and Liquors, though not attributed to any author, might explain why Chinon, the region's largest red wine appellation of the three, therefore the one you would think would be the most popular, is still a hard sell. It is not full of tannin like the Bordeaux, nor is it deliciously toxic like the Burgundy, the anonymous reviewer says. It is a wine for intellectuals. Evidently, that was written in a time when being called an intellectual was not the slur it is today. Pascaline and I drink the wines from all three appellations, so sure, go ahead and call us names. The dirt. While the three towns of the Touraine share similar soils and climate, wet and mild near the Atlantic, moderate by the rivers, they have distinct identities. While only minutes away from each other, the closer inland they are, the less influenced they are by the winds and the humidity from the Atlantic Ocean, with Chinon being the warmest. Chinon lies on the Vienne River. A nuclear power plant overlooks its most famous vineyard, Les Picasses. It is the most southeast of the three, located on the left bank of the Loire. As with the other two appellations, the wines from the Tuffeau slopes are profound, while the ones on the cooler alluvial flat are simpler. The wines get aged in wood for a year or longer when raised in the limestone, and just gets a quick fermentation and élevage when coming from the sand. Their rare plantings of Chinon are worth the hunt. The local rosés can be perfect and edgy spring-summer companions. To the north on the Loire sit the other two jewels of the Touraine. Bourgogne, like Chinon, grows the best wines in the mid-slopes, and they are said to have more of a rustic edge with coarser tannins. Just try those from Pierre Breton and Domaine de la Chevalerie and be prepared to have your mind blown. Here, as in Chinon, the wines benefit from longer aging in wood. Saint-Nicolas is flatter, and there's more alluvial sand and less limestone. There, the grape will give a lighter, easy-to-drink red that producers do best vinifying simply, though there are exceptions to the rule. The grapes. Cabernet Franc on the right soils retain acidity and show gentle fruit, yet this grape is prone to some vegetal flavor, most prominently of green bell pepper. The grapes don't get to full ripeness. But when it blends its raspberry perfume with herbal aromas, it makes for a heady, seductive, philosophical conversation in a glass. Cabernet Franc loves Tuffeau mixed with a little sand and clay because of its ability to clutch onto water and give the grape a drink when needed. Who to drink? Chenon. Domaine Baudry, organic. Catherine et Pierre Breton, biodynamic. Pascal Lambert, biodynamic. Olga Raffaut, conversion to organic. Patrick Corbineau, organic. Chateau de Coulin, organic. Domaine de l'Eure, organic. Cave Les Roches, Jérôme Lenoir, organic. Gérald Maroula, organic. Nicolas Grosbois, biodynamic. Bourgogne. Domaine de la Chevalerie, biodynamic. Catherine et Pierre Breton, biodynamic. Domaine de Mortier, organic. Pierre Borel, organic. Domaine Stéphane Guyon, organic. Laurent Elon, biodynamic. Domaine de Loubier, organic. Auréline Révillon, biodynamic. Domaine des Ouches, sustainable. Saint-Nicolas de Bourgogne. Yannick Amereau, organic. Domaine de Mortier, organic. Sébastien David, biodynamic. Anjou Blanc. Just next door to Bourgogne are glorious red wine zones that have gone missing. Anjou Blanc Sommet Champigny, for example, received appellation status for whites and reds only in 1957. Cabernet Sauvignon and Pinot Donis are allowed in the AOP, but as limestone is friendly to Cabernet Franc, there are many fine domains producing it in a single varietal, mano cépage. But despite some classy wines, such as Clos Rougeard, a veritable cult Cabernet Franc, the area maintains a downmarket reputation for mindless, chillable reds. That notoriety is infuriating to those who collect the wines. The dirt. This region is split into schist and limestone-derived soils. That's the reason they are often referred to as black and white, respectively. For this conversation, proceed directly to the metamorphic section in Chapter 3. But meanwhile, for the Anjou regions on the limestone, the ones that circle the town of Saumur, you're in the right place. The grapes. André Julien is sometimes called the founder of modern wine writing. In his 1816 Topographie de tous les vignobles connus, Topography of All Known Vineyards, he wrote that red wines constitute a very small portion of what the Anjou vineyards produce and are, with some exceptions, coarse and of low quality. There was one major exception, in Julien's opinion. Champigny le Sec, the original name for the commune of Sucé-Champigny, about 15 minutes from Clos Rougeard. Julien wrote that the area produced full-bodied wines with a dark color, good taste, and generous texture. He added that after 4 to 5 years of aging, they finally become expressive. In 1845, the ampelographer, Alexandre-Pierre Audard, seconded that emotion. The Breton vine, Breton is the old name for Cabernet Franc, is a veritable Proteus, expressing the locality where it is planted. For example, in the small district of Champigny-le-Sec, where the vineyards are on limestone, the wine is outstanding and higher priced than Bordeaux. Feel free to look around, though. There's some marvelous wines to be had outside of Somme-Champigny, such as around Puy-Notre-Dame, a new appellation with a long history, located towards the west of the region, where there is more silex in the soil and a little more Cabernet Sauvignon. Who to drink? François Saint-Lô, Vin de France, organic. Domaine Cousin Les Ducs, Olivier Cousin, Vin de France, biodynamic. Le Bateau-Say, Baptiste Cousin, Vin de France, biodynamic. Les Jardins Esmeraldin, Xavier Caliard, Vin de France, organic. La Tour Grise, Philippe Gordon. Sommet, Puy Notre-Dame, Avon de France, Biodynamic. Château de Fosseiche, Sommet, Biodynamic. Domaine de Collière, Sommet, Organic. Domaine Andrier, Stéphane Écrisé, Vin de France, Organic. Domaine Méliarc, Sommet, Puy Notre-Dame, Organic. La Porte Saint-Jean, Sylvain Dittier, Sommet Champagny, Organic. Clos Rougeard, Sommet Champagny, Organic. Piemonte. When it comes to this region in Italy's Northwest Territory, I'm like a local dog with a Piemontese white truffle, all consumed, obsessed, and hormonally activated. I'm not alone in this, of course. As far back as 77 AD, Pliny the Elder noted in his Natural History that the area around the Tanaro River in the Longa region was a place for good wines. But while their charms were noted centuries ago, the raging success has only started to creep up since the 1950s, and now Piemonte excites a passion amongst its devotees for wines that speak to structure and expression. The region has the Ligurian Sea about an hour to the west and is flanked by France and Switzerland. But it also has the Alps looming over it, where the name and the microclimates come from. Pia equals feet. Monte equals mountain. And of course, it's beautiful. In the spring, the trees burst into bloom like freshly popped corn. Fragrant violets fill the vineyards. In the fall, there's the blinding fog that shrouds the region ominously. The landscape is crazily chopped up, and the vines are on the slopes. Red-roofed hilltop villages seem like vine-covered bubbles. Piemonte has a peaceful, regal beauty, an innate elegance, a mixture of northern cultures. It remains feistily Italian, and the wine? Oh, yes, it speaks more of its struggle than easy sun. When it comes to wine and longevity, that is a good thing. There are four major regions here. If you speed, Monferrato is an hour from the Milan airport. Here you avoid the monotony of vineyard monoculture with its mixed crop and all manner of fruit trees. In the fall, unfortunately, the mosquitoes move in, thanks to the rice paddies not too far away, but the wines, even if little known, don't bite. They are earthy, savory, and fresh, especially the Fresa, Nebbiolo, and the DOCG Barbera. Flanking Turin is the clay and limestone heavy region of Asti. This gets the DOCG for Barbera, as well as its fizzy and slightly sweet Moscato. No comment. Roero, with its soils laden with gypsum, an ingredient in plaster of Paris, has yet to find its way, or even its champion, despite its location between Asti and Alba, and its ability to grow some credible Nebbioli. And finally, we arrive at the region's star, Langhe. The dirt. The soils here have their origin in the sea and the mountains. When the Padano Sea retreated about 16 million years ago, it left a collection of marine sediments and God knows what else that accumulated over the millions of years in the basin. The area's structuring and stratification began 1 million years later during the Miocene epoch, when tensions from the Apennines and the Alps caused a mountainous collapse. Underneath it all, those bodies of marine animals decomposed and mixed with clay, becoming marls and gypsum. Another factor for the region is more recent. About 65,000 years ago, the river Tanaro changed directions from northerly to easterly. This accelerated erosion, and a division arose between the more marl-rich soils of the Langhe and the younger, sandier soils of Roero. Within the Barolo zone, there are two major soil types separated by the Alba-Barolo road: the younger Tortonian calcareous marl on the west and the older Helvetian sandstone on the east. The marl is said to produce more feminine wines, while the sandstone is said to produce more longer-lived and stronger ones. But while these stereotypes could be true, since there are so many other variables such as vinification and farming, I trust you'll take those generalities with grains of salt. The winters can be harsh, cold, and wet. Summers are hot. Falls are lingering and cool, and this allows the grapes, especially the late-harvested Nebbiolo, to hang and ripen after the others have been picked. The fog is also a factor. It starts as the cooler weather rolls in, further slowing down the ripening and perhaps also adding to the mystery. In the end, this soil births what might be the world's best white truffles and a red wine. Where Nebbiolo surely is king, but do not deny the supporting cast of characters, they are marvelous. The grapes. If they had asked me, there would be no grapes like Pinot Noir, Cabernet, Merlot, or Chardonnay in Piemonte. While I have to admit that the Pinot can do quite well there, the truth of the region lies within their indigenous grapes that just don't really succeed anywhere else. About 35% of the acreage belongs to white wine. Moscato d'Asti, the sparkling sweet wine from Moscato, is only good from a few producers, such as Berra. There is some light and acidic Erba Luce, the favorite of some drinkers. For me, it is a little forgettable, but pleasant enough. There is also Arnais, a low-acid variety that has never really moved me. While most of the whites are minor league, there is one huge exception, Cortese. Grown in the southeastern portion of the DOC of Gavi, it is synonymous with its place. In the hands of some, like the bad boy rabble-rouser and biodynamic since 1985 Stefano Ballate, with his Cascina degli Ulivi on those red clay limestone soils, the Cortese grape shows a magnificent expression, and don't miss his Dolcetto or Nebbiolos either. Carusin makes a more polite version of Cortese, blended with some Carica Lacino, an old variety whose name means load up the donkey. But the reds, this is what you are here to drink. Dolcetto. Early ripening and low in acid, this is one of the first of the big Piemonte three, Barbera, Dolcetto, and Nebbiolo, that makes it to the table. Its name means little sweet, though it is neither, being in reality nicely tannic and sturdy. But no one lately can figure out what the wine is. A lot has been made in stainless steel, with no wood aging, and pushed out for an early drinker. It can be a totally gorgeous wine. There are places that are famed for it and receive the DOCG. Diano d'Alba, Doliani, and Ovado, where it usually gets planted where others don't ripen. The best producers are probably also the best producers of Barolo and Barbaresco. If you find any from Rinaldi, Capilano, Mascarello, or Roagna, for example, snap them up. Look also for Nicoletta Bocca's age-worthy variations from Sanferrello. While she is known for her Barberas, her Dolcettos are even more noteworthy, not released before 8 years of aging so as to show the rustic greatness of the grape. Barbera. Barbera shows up in Lombardy and Emilia-Romagna. California went through a flirtation with it, but the grape is mostly important in Piemonte, where it is the most planted, even if it has been reduced by half over the past 20 years. The reason for its popularity? It ripens 2 weeks later than the others, but still earlier than Nebbiolo. Traditionally, it was second in the hierarchy of drinking. Dolcetto for every day, Barbera for Sunday dinner, then Nebbiolo for something fancier, and finally, Barolo and Barbaresco for grand occasions. And as far as at the table, it is famed as the classic pizza wine because its ripeness coupled with acidity makes it unbeatable. Barbera is said to have originated in the hills of Monferrato. Fabrizio Iuli, a champion of the grape in his region, says it excels on the loose soil, a mixture of clay, silt, and a significant amount of limestone. But even though both Asti and Monferrato's Barbera have a DOCG status, the one from Asti remains more well-known. As with Dolcetto and Nebbiolo, and often Freisia, most of the great Barolo and Barbaresco producers make small amounts of Barbera that are worth getting a hold of. Freisia. Talk about a grape that gets no respect. It's shameful, given that this is one of the area's oldest, longest-lived grapes and a cousin of Nebbiolo. It often falls into the love-it-or-loathe-it category in the grape tomes. The nice people say it is wild strawberry-like, but that is stretching the grape's charms into a profile that may or may not be true. The ones you're looking for are not fizzy, frothy varieties, but the rare vintages by winemakers who treat it the same way they would Nebbiolo. It needs age for its natural tannins to mellow, and then it does get fruity on the nose with a long depth of pleasure. Look to some of the best Barolo producers, who also make wonderful Freisia. Giuseppe Rinaldi Berlotto and Principanio Ferdinando are of note. Grignolino. Here's another grape that gets no respect. You won't find much of it, and few people give it the love it needs. And Grignolino can be confusing. It defies acquiring color and can have aggressive tannins. This is why so much of it ends up, like Freisia, in sparkling throwaways or rosés, instead of giving it the respect it deserves. But there are some around if you dig deep, even if they are in minute amounts. Check out the one from Scarpa in Monferrato, or from Asti, Trincero, and Cascina, Travine. Give them some time to age up. You'll have a surprise in store. Pella Verga. A rare beauty that we need more of. It's tricky to grow and needs to be picked immediately before it loses its livey acidity. Here is a Loire attitude with a Piemontese character. It has been maligned, dismissed as a silly little grape, but thankfully some people have raised it from the dead. As Levi Dalton said in the Food Quarterly, The Art of Eating, people see Pella Verga for the very traits that nearly lead to its demise, meaning no deep color, no deep structure, no heavy tannins, and a food-friendly pour. Do seek out those from Berlotto, Castello di Verduno, and Olec Bondonio. Rouquet. Pronounced Rouquet, this one is a charmer. And there's very little of it around, even though there's a DOCG for it in Castagnole Monferrato. There, in the hands of Cascina Travine, it is a wine of aromatic pleasure and density. Nebbiolo. Sheldon Wasserman mused in his 1990 book, Italy's Noble Red Wines, on the true identity of the grape Pliny had rhapsodized about, a late-ripening and cold-resistant black grape. Pliny called it Allobrogica, but according to Wasserman, it sure sounded a lot like Nebbiolo. This grape is luckily resistant to frost and stands up to the local fog, which is lucky. While some believe that's where the grape gets its name, the erudite writer Jancis Robinson opines that it's more likely because of the fog-like bloom that adheres to the variety. Often, it's compared to Pinot Noir, not so much in taste as in how fussy it is to soil. It likes that marly clay and hillsides. Grown in all areas of northern Italy, but the name changes, it's called Chiavenesca in the Lombardia region of Valtellina. In the region of Alto Piemonte, it's called Spana. In the Valle d'Aosta, it's Picotoner. No matter the name, Nebbiolo can provide wines of extreme beauty that can live certainly longer than 30 years, especially when grown in the right zones and in the right conditions, and entitled to become Barolo and Barbaresco. When it's just right, it blends complex aromas and tastes of rose petal, tar, and fennel. Who to drink? Outside of the Langa? Iluli, Monferrato, organic. Miglavacca, Monferrato, organic. Antica Casa Vinicola Scarpa, Monferrato, sustainable. Vittorio Bera e Figli, Asti, organic. Trincero, Asti, organic. Carusin, Asti, organic. Cascina Tavine, Asti, organic. Cascina Dili Uvili, Gavi, biodynamic. Barbaresco and Barolo. Barbaresco is produced just east of Alba, from the very same grape as Barolo and Nebbiolo, and in this compact area that produces only about a third of the quantity of Barolo, the vines are planted more in amphitheaters than on hills. Maybe it's my own perception, but I always have the idea that I am being hugged by the vines here, as opposed to being on top of them. The main townships are Barbaresco, Neve, and Treso, and as the vineyards are closer to the Tanaro River, and thus richer, that might offer one reason why they ripen earlier than their slightly more elite neighbor. The soils are Tortonian, as with the west side of Barolo. It is said that the resulting wines are less tannic, softer, perhaps more fruity. While they don't have the reputation of being as long-lived, that doesn't mean they don't keep, only that they come around to drinking a bit sooner, and, oh, they cost a little less. A drop less, This is not a bad thing. Even though it is easy to talk of Barbaresco and Barolo by comparisons, it is important to drink these wines in their own right as they have their own identity, even if they echo similar hints of roses, tar, leather, and violet. The wines must be aged for a minimum of 26 months, with at least 9 months in wood. The Reserva wines get 50 months before being released, with the same minimum 9 months in oak. Barolo was my gateway drug, and I certainly wasn't the first to discover it. Pliny can probably claim that honor. The 1968 Barolo I sipped in the year 1980, the year Barolo was given its DOCG status, one of the country's first, was life-changing, showing me the specific spiritual pull of fermented grape juice. But like much of Italy's wines, Barolo took a while to find itself. The modern era for Barolo started in the 1950s when the region started to lock down a way to make a dry wine with consistency. But in the late 1970s, something else happened. New barrels. And that was the beginning of a revolution that nearly wiped out the wines of both Barolo and Barbaresco. In an effort to make this wine drinkable earlier, in came the rotor fermenters and other technology. People stopped making wine naturally and started using toasted Bordeaux barrels and even adding Cabernet Sauvignon to the wine to increase the purple color. The land split into the traditionalists and the modernists, with Bartolo Mascarello the most verbal of the traditionalists. The most public issue was trading in the large traditional oak and chestnut barrels called Botti for the brand new barrels used in Bordeaux called Barrique. These often left a hard texture and tastes like blueberry and vanilla. But there were other issues as well. The modernists tried to soften the wines before their time using many different kind of additives and new machines. The traditionalists? They clung to the old barrels that did not change the wine's flavors, worked with natural yeasts and more gentle methods in general. It's important to remember that this exalted area for the vine also birthed a fierce cluster of partisans who fought in their own way against fascism and Nazis and also made wine. Mascarello was one of them. At least in my mind, all this history, climate, landscape, and heroism helps to infuse the best of the wines with a complex and profound taste. Mascarello died in 2005. But his capable daughter, Maria Teresa, is carrying on his tradition. Now the region is coming back to its senses, and more people are working in a way that allows the wine to reveal itself more naturally. The 11 communes of Barolo. To the east of the Alba, Barolo Road with more sandstone. La Mora, Barolo, Castiglione, Faletto, Serralunga d'Alba, Monforte d'Alba. To the west of the Alba, Barolo Road with more limestone. Verduno, Rodi, Grinzane Cavour, Diano d'Alba, Novello, Cherasco. What's in a Barolo DOCG? There are laws concerning how long a wine needs to be aged and in what kind of container. For a Barolo, here's the deal. 1. The wine must be 100% Nebbiolo. 2. Minimum alcohol is 13%. 3. Barolo requires 38 months of aging from November 1st of the harvest year, including 18 months of aging in wood. 4. Barolo Reserva requires 62 months of aging from November 1st of the harvest year and at least 18 months in wood. 5. The vines must be planted at a minimum elevation of 170 meters and a maximum of 540 meters. 6. Complete northern exposures of vineyards are prohibited. Note, they might want to rethink this, as in our currently changing climate, alcohols are getting very high with southern and western exposures. 7. The yield is controlled at 56 hectoliters per hectare, and the vines must be at least 7 years old. For a wine with the newly allowed designation of a single vineyard, Vigna, the yields are even lower. Winemaker Profile, Lorenzo Accumasso. As we tried to suss out which apartment was Lorenzo Accumasso's, I noticed some roosters doing a damn good imitation of a Chagall painting, perched on the roof of a coop's hut. We then walked into an open door, into a disheveled receiving room, and saw the baseball-capped, blue-eyed Barolo legend himself waiting for us. Lorenzo Accumasso of La Mora is an outsider as well as a holdout for tradition. The winemaker is now in his 70s and only speaks in the Piemontese dialect. This is why Giorgio, a Piemontese man who lives in and imports wine into Australia and wants Lorenzo for his portfolio, convinced Marta Rinaldi, the daughter of noted producer Giuseppe Rinaldi, to come along and interpret. Accumasso talked slowly and poured even slower. He finally allowed us the dregs of two open bottles while he rattled on to Marta. I sipped. I scribbled. These wines are my new heartthrobs. Lorenzo is an elderly bad boy who makes thrilling wines, at least based on the two that I tasted that afternoon. I'd never had them before, as they are currently not available in the United States. I imagine they still linger on some wine lists purchased in the days when Winebow was their stateside importer, but Lorenzo stopped that relationship 15 years back. He found the process too much hassle. The back label, the front label, the rules, and the red tape. He is old-fashioned, traditional Barolo, showing off all of that Barolo-ness that left me speechless before I had a wine vocabulary. The road tar, roses, licorice, and something like a fine, sun-bleached Brooks bicycle seat. His fermentation occurs in cement vats for about 25 days, with maceration on the skins. Then it goes into a big old botti. Done. Those barriquistas used to try to convince me to use barrique, the sky-blue-eyed winemaker said. Those barriquistas failed. It was obvious Accumasso is a stubborn guy who can't be convinced to do anything he doesn't want to do. Something had happened in the middle of the translations, and Marta's voice changed. I saw she had started to pick her fingers and blush. What is he telling her? I asked Giorgio. He could make out a little of the conversation and whispered to me. He said he had lots of girlfriends and women friends he'd have loved to take to bed, but he didn't want to mess with the friendships. Ah, I thought, the roosters weren't only on the roof. If Lorenzo was gunning for Marta, a clear 45 years his junior, then good luck to this fine winemaker with the missing teeth, sparkling eyes, and mischievous grin. He finally poured us one more wine, the Rocca. It had more color, with a needly mouth, rustic edges, a touch of good and plenty candy, and fresh, salty air. They're not polished, he said of his wines. Thank goodness for that. But if you want to drink them, you'll have to go to Germany or Japan, or, better still, go knock on his door. He is brilliant stuff, but it's over when Accumasso is over. Seek him out, bring cash, or maybe just bring Marta instead. Who to drink? Barolo. Capilano, organic. Ferdinando Principiano, organic. Giuseppe Rinaldi, organic. Flavio Rudolo, organic. Roagna, organic. Brovia, sustainable. Giovanni Canonica, organic. Lorenzo Accumasso, sustainable. Bartolo Mascarello, organic. Scarpa, sustainable. Barbaresco. Roagna, biodynamic. Cascina del Rose, organic. Canova, organic. Roccalini, organic. Fabio Gea, organic. Produttori del Barbaresco, conventional. Rioja. I was standing in the middle of gnarled Tempranillo vines, poking out of what seemed to be deep soil and a cobblestone road of river stones. White and yellow rocks the size of the county bones my mother used to put in her tomato soup were scattered everywhere. A few feet down the slope, toward the river, was an abrupt transition into sandy soils. This is Rioja, a distinguished piece of Spain that almost no one talks about anymore. Over the past 20 years, they lost most of their old customers as they pursued making more conventional tasting wines and losing their soul in the process. But no worries, they picked up plenty of others and is the most known region in the country. About 100 miles southeast of Bilbao, in north-central Spain, Rioja is a relatively new wine region. There's evidence that the Romans made wine there, and there was also a local industry in the 15th century. But it was in the 1860s when Rioja came to prominence thanks to phylloxera. When the louse decimated Bordeaux, the winemakers at the top of the wine game needed to find a place to plant vines and to bring in wines. Rioja had access to the ocean. At least the town of Haro, which became a locus of wine activity, was. The region was an hour's train ride from the Atlantic, and there it was, an easy sail to Bordeaux. The French came en masse, brought their small barrels, and started businesses and relations. But the Spanish found American oak was cheaper, and that distinct taste helped to define the Riojan style. In the 1900s, when Bordeaux was back on its feet, it was Rioja's turn to get hit by the pest. There went the vines. Ouch. The vines in the sandy soils were safe, since phylloxera can't abide sand. But under those limestone, quartz, rocks was a mix of limestone and clay, and the pest feasted. Bye-bye, Rioja. Rioja discovered, as did the rest of the world, that they needed to graft the vine onto the roots of American vines, which were immune, instead of directly planting into the soil as in the past. There were ups and downs, fungus and civil war, then World War II and Franco. Finally, modern Spanish wine came into its own around the 1960s, only to find another problem 30 years later. Modernization. The dirt. Rioja is a mix of climates and microclimates, so it's really hard to generalize. Is it Atlantic cool and wet? Is it Mediterranean hot and dry, or continental, with swings between hot and cold? A little of all three profiles apply to this region, which sits in a bumpy bowl between two mountain ranges, the Cantabrian Mountains to the north and the Sierra de la Demanda to the south. Within, there are seven rivers and seven valleys carving up its terrain. There are numerous microclimates, and often harvest doesn't come around until October. There are three pieces to the Rioja puzzle. Rioja Alta is where most of the vines around Haro, the center for the Rioja explosion in the 1800s, exist. These are mostly limestone mixed with clay and alluvial sand. The Alavesa is just north, higher elevation, with the highest concentration of calcareous clay soils. Then there is the southern part, Rioja Baja, east of the city of Logroño. Here, it's iron-laced clay and alluvial, warmer and flatter, and often thought of as a lesser place for wine with more Grenache than Tempranillo. Not saying that some wines can't be made there, but in Rioja, where there is limestone, it just seems to be finer. López de Herida is a much-loved Haro winery with roots stretching back to the 1800s. Won by Maria José López de Herida, her sister Mercedes, and their brother Julio César, they are vocal about not having changed any element of their winemaking since their great-grandfather. Julio took me into the vines, anchored in varied soil with dips and turns in the topography, ranging from big white boulders to silky sand. Sand gives structure. Limestone, slow maturation, he said. Taking me high up to their Alavesa site, where they get their grapes for their cubillo, the vine's struggle on the pure chalk was obvious. We're between the Mediterranean and the Atlantic, said Jorge Muga, a winemaker from another venerable house, so we could be classified as either. The thing about Rioja, Muga said, is that terroir is more dominant than the grape. That might be, but it's not more dominant than technique or process. The process, characterized by long aging in American oak for up to 3 years, longer for the wines of López de Heredia, marks the wine. Yet one could recognize it as Rioja because of the spiced wood and the old Bureau kind of odors. But in a truly traditional wine, the flavors of chicken soup and dill with touches of iron, blood, and depth were all in balance. Today's techniques, using super ripe grapes, especially Grenache from Baja, and technology engaged to make sure the wine tastes the same, yeasts, enzymes, micro-oxygenation, concentrators, have made the wines chunky and inelegant. My grandmother, Muga said, was a great winemaker. She could blind taste her way through all of the wines from the villages. Today, I can't tell the differences in continent.